Tonight on Arena, Simon Fisher-Turner on the upcoming live performance of his music for Derek Jarman's Blue, and Neville Thompson on how his Ballyfermot set novel became a French cinematic sensation. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. On November the 23rd, the National Concert Hall in Dublin will host Blue Now, a live performance of Derek Jarman's final film, Blue. The 1993 film remains a seminal work in the fight against the stigma of AIDS. The original soundtrack, composed by Simon Fisher-Turner, will be reimagined for this performance in collaboration with cellist and composer Lucy Railton, and it will be directed by Neil Bartlett. Blue Now will also feature the voices of Russell Tovey, Travis Alabanza, Jay Barnard and Joelle Taylor on the night, lending fresh perspectives to Jarman's poignant reflections. Simon Fisher-Turner, long-time collaborator of Derek Jarman's, and he created the soundtracks for several of the filmmaker's iconic works. I'm delighted to have Simon join us on Arena this evening. And I just love the way your initial contact with Derek Jarman came about. It really was down to chance in many ways, Simon.
I'm afraid it was, but you know, chance is a fine thing, really. That's what life seems to throw up on us constantly, and I think we have to sort of embrace these chances that all the gods send us.
Yeah, and just to, for people who don't know the story of how it came about, that you were literally plucked off the street and into the coterie of Derek Jarman, maybe you'd tell them.
Well, it is true. I was sitting on what can only be described as King's Road in Chelsea in London in a summer's afternoon, and I was rattling away, just sitting there watching the world go by. And a gentleman approached me and asked me who I was. And I said, I'm Simon Turner. And he went, well, good heavens, I interviewed you when you were 15 years old and you were extremely precocious and rather rude. And I went, well, obviously I apologized profusely and everything. And he I didn't remember him in particular or anything, because I was doing lots of sort of teen interviews at the time. Anyway, turned out that this gentleman, Guy Ford, was a film producer who was producing a film directed by Derek Jarman, who, of course, I'd never heard of. And so he asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm just watching the world go by, left, right, just watching people, because people watching is sort of a hobby. And he said, do you need a job? And I went, yes, I do, actually, funnily enough. And he said, can you drive? I went, yes, I can. He said, have you got a clean driving license? I said, yes, I have. And we went from there, and I found myself the next day in a house in Holland Park in London. And it was at lunchtime, and I was introduced to all sorts of people. And then somebody, another of the producers, in fact, Howard said, okay, Simon, nice to meet you. You know, do you want to help with lunch? I went, yes. He said, what can you do? I went, salad dressing. So, I can make a mean salad dressing.
Salad dressing.
And off we went. And then it was sort of them. And that was the beginning. That really was the beginning of my journey with Mr. Jarman.
Yeah, salad dressing is the unknown route to film composition with the work of Derek Jarman. But I mentioned that whole idea of chance and how these things, as you say, Simon, do kind of just happen out of nowhere, or so it might seem. How would you describe, what is the role of chance in the work of Derek Jarman? What did he do that left the possibilities of things happening? How did he leave that door open, which he seems to have been able to do in his work?
Yes, well, how did he do it? He collected friends, I suppose, and he collected people who made him laugh and who enjoyed working hard and enjoyed perhaps going places they hadn't gone before. And he sort of put us all together. I mean, really, we were all sort of ingredients in a sort of paella he was making. And we'd all jump around trying to make the paella as fine as we could. So also in another way, I suppose one could think of him as being the sun and we're little planets zooming about and stars and shooting stars. And we gravitated around him. So he'd come up with ideas like, Simon, I really want fantastic. I can see a really big, you know, sort of a big choir here or something like that. And I go, OK. And I take it on board and I go, well, we haven't got the money for a choir, but I know a really good singer.
Right. At what point did it become clear, though, or did you have to put up your hand and say, by the way, as well as making a mean salad dressing, I can also put a few notes together and make a film score? When did that kind of surface?
Well, it surfaced because I'd worked on The Tempest, and when we were making The Tempest, I was in charge of looking after the rats, buying cider, driving people to the railway station and back, doing all sorts of things, kind of odd job man. And because we were on location outside Coventry in this beautiful old broken down castle, we used to sort of have entertainment evenings, because I don't think we really had the budget to all stay in hotels. So we stayed in this vast sort of empty house we were living in, and we put on shows. And then Derek knew that I'd made records, and then because I'd made records, he assumed that I was a fabulous musician, which I wasn't.
Yeah, and you had made records, though, it has to be said, you had made records with David Bowie, David and Angie Bowie. It wasn't that you were just making records that were disappearing into the ether.
Well, I suppose they weren't disappearing into the ether, were they? They were just not selling as much as they perhaps might want to. They may have been dreadful as well, but gradually, I mean, I did sort of, you know, I did actually want to make music, but I also, because of being a sort of bad teen television actor, I also knew how films were made, and I loved working on films. And so when it came to, for instance, Caravaggio, which was the first proper film of his I scored, he said, you want to be in it or on it? And I went on it. So I got all the extras, all the, you know, background casting for the Caravaggio film. And then he asked me to be in it as Fra Filippo, which meant I had to get a tonsure. And of course I said, yes, I'd love a tonsure, not even knowing that I was going to be one of the few people in London with a tonsure. And then at the end, after all the filming completed, I was around his flat one day, and I had recently released a solo album, and he was listening to it, and he said, "Listen, it's crazy. Why don't you just do the music for Caravaggio? You know what we've done. You know how it feels." And I went, "Okay, yeah, that would be incredible." And he said, "But you mustn't mess it up, you know. Yeah, and it mustn't be electric." He said, "I said, don't worry. You know, we'll go for authentic instruments, beautiful classical players, and that's what we started out trying to do."
And it was the beginning of a long and fruitful set of collaborative works between the two of you and those other friends, those other parts of the paella that I'm sure changed and varied throughout the years. The piece that you're bringing to the National Concert Hall towards the end of the month, Simon, is Blue Now, which is a live performance of the score for Derek Jarman's final film, Blue. I mean, an extraordinary piece of work, which has, in terms of the visuals, we have this Yves Klein blue screen sitting for us to look at. But it's what's happening in the auditory imagination that really comes to the fore in this film.
Well, it does and it doesn't, I have to say. For me, the main instrument of the film is the text. So the text is all. And so what Lucy Railton, the cellist we're playing with at the moment, what her and I are doing is underscoring the film in a much dreamier sense than the original score. There's only a couple of bits of music which are sort of related to the original score of the film, because the film, in fact, was very bitty and very complicated sound-wise and music-wise. There was lots of editing and lots of short, sharp little cues and everything. And so for this, I've found, for me as a musician or a non-musician or as a composer, the best way to really get into the film is to take you on a dreamy soundscape, which is a sort of mystery to us all.
Yeah. And I don't know how much it has changed from your performance at the Brighton Festival in 2023, but I want to listen to a little extract of that. I'm sure some of it must be the same, because we have two of the performers in this extract for sure, Joelle Taylor and Travis Alabanza. Let's have a listen to what's called Pearl Fishers from Blue Now, and we'll come back to you then.
Pearl fishers in azure seas, deep waters washing the Isle of the Dead in coral harbours, amphora spill gold across the still seabed. We lie there, fanned by the billowing sails of forgotten ships, tossed by the mournful winds of the deep.
Lost boys sleep forever in a dear embrace, salt lips touching in submarine gardens. Cool marble fingers touch an antique smile. Shell sounds whisper, deep love drifting on the tide. Forever.
The voices there of Joel Taylor and Travis Alabanza in a section, The Pearl Fishers from Blue Now, which is the live performance of Simon Fisher Turner's composition for Derek Jarman's final film, Blue. I can see, I can hear as I listen to that, as Freudian slip to say, I can see as I listen to it, Simon, that has that dreamy quality, I think, that you were talking about, perhaps much dreamier than the original.
Yes, much dreamier. But funnily enough, those are bell-like creatures there. We've dumped those, for instance. So they're out, because it sounds a bit odd, but they were sort of too easy. So really we've gone for a completely new beginning, because the cup gongs used to begin the film.
Yes.
And they used to end the film, and they used to begin and end the concerts. And then Neil Bartlett, the director, and I'd explained to him earlier this year that I wanted to do it completely differently. And I explained sort of what I've told you, really. I wanted to be more dreamy. And so he went, well, that's great. So let's start with Lucy playing the cello, and we'll end with Lucy playing the cello, which is fantastic. So she sets the scene she sets it up completely and she ends it. So we begin and we end in a nice circular journey.
And in the original film, it was the words of Derek Jarman. He voiced those words, and a lot of it reflections on his situation and the AIDS epidemic at that time. Do we get any of his words on tape, or is everything performed absolutely live by the other performers that are on stage with you?
Everything is live on stage. But of course, I do have a computer on stage, which is sort of one of the things I play. But you know, I have thought about it. I've thought about surprising them, because the actors don't really know what I'm going to do. They have a vague idea of the sound world I'm working from, but I have thought about it, but I haven't put it in. But I'll tell you what. Now you've said that, I might try and look for a tape of him laughing or something like that. That could be quite good.
Yeah,
I would love to get a bit of Derek in there, but I'm not quite sure. Now I'm afraid
I've started your scratch. The scratches,
you have,
at you
I'm
now.
Afraid, but I think very quickly with these concerts as well, and I sort of set up a variety, and not unlike the way we all worked with Derek. I sort of get lots of things ready, which I can or cannot play with and everything. So I have my large saucepan full of sounds. And then it's just a matter of how I feel, when to play things, how to play things, whether things can be tuned, how I can affect them. And also, of course, I have a grand piano, which is a magnificent creature in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I wondered about is to what extent the text changes from venue for venue and from performance to performance. I mean, for example, this was written originally in and around the time of the Bosnian War, and there are mention of Bosnian refugees in it. That would be potent in and of itself in the contemporary world, or have you changed or updated that in any ways to maybe reflect some of the current situations worldwide?
Oh, you're really digging for secrets there. But I have to say, that's well observed as well, because quite rightly, I always felt that we should update the situations happening. And so indeed, as you probably suspect, they have been updated.
Well, I wasn't digging for you to give away anything that you didn't want to.
But, no, I was quite happy. It's always been a discussion. It has always been a discussion. And it's something that we keep the original Bosnian War, and then we elaborate.
And you have other things in your saucepan of sounds, as you put it, that potentially can be used on the night. Simon, been great to talk with you, and a very interesting project indeed. And I'm sure people will enjoy it enormously if they get to see it. Thanks for speaking with us on Arena this evening.
It's my pleasure. You stay well, all of you.
You too. That's Simon Fisher-Turner, and November the 23rd, Perspectives is the series that brings Blue Now, a new live performance of Gerrick Jarman's last film, Blue, to the National Concert Hall stage. Simon Fisher-Turner will be there with his saucepan of sounds, along with Russell Tovey, Travis Alabanza, Jay Bernard, Joelle Taylor and Lucy Railton. NCH.ie for full details. The French Film Festival, which is currently running at the Irish Film Institute, brings us a wonderful love story against a backdrop of crime created from a unique French-Irish collaboration. One of the key songs in the film was made famous by Sinead O'Connor. But we hear in this movie the Prince's version of his own composition, Nothing Compares to You. Nothing Compares to You from Prince, a song that is at the core of the Irish-inspired French film L'Amour Ouf, or Beating Hearts, a film that has captured the imagination of teenage cinema-goers all over France. The film, however, is based on an Irish novel set in Ballyfermot. Jackie Loves Jonzer, OK, is the title of that novel by Irish writer Neville Thompson. Jonzer, in the novel, is a petty criminal, meets and falls in love with Jackie, but Johnson's hard man attitude allows another young woman and criminality get in the way of their teenage romance. We know from the beginning of the novel that Jonzer and Jackie do get back together, but Jonzer may be facing the tragic end that awaits many criminals. Film version is set in a town in northern France. Jonzer is now a character called Clotaire, played as a teenager by Malik Fricka and as a man by Francois Civil. And Jackie is played by Mallory Wanak as a teenager, and by Blue is the Warmest Colours, Adele Exarchopoulos as an adult. The film is directed by Gilles Lelouch, who got a copy of Jackie Loves Johnser from an actor friend and decided to create his own version of the love story, and the resulting film is a very French take on the Ballyfermot-based story. Both book and film have at their very hearts a tale of timeless love. The writer of Jackie Loves Johnser, OK, is Neville Thompson. Delighted to be joined by Neville this evening. That original story of Jackie Loves Johnser, how did it get into the hands of a French director, Gilles Lelouch, who wanted to make a film version of it? I think it's been in his hands for quite a while, in fact, Neville.
I'll tell you. It's a well-known fact in Ballyfermot, the minute that we get up in the morning and look out the window, we go, ooh la la, you know. So it was a natural progression. No, basically, the book was out. It was out 5 years. Everyone was saying, oh, it has to be a film, you know, it has to be an Irish film. And really, nobody came for it. Mm. And this guy, who I actually taught until a couple of weeks ago, you know, the way I have no pronunciation, and I was very glad you went for all the pronunciations there of their names, because I thought his name was Giles, like Johnny Giles. So I was going around in Paris, everybody saying, where's Giles? You know, and they hadn't a clue who I was talking about. But it got into his hands. And no, like I say, nobody else had come for it. He was a young guy back then, the same as myself, and kept on saying, listen, the time has to be right. It's not right at the moment. I'm not big enough, you know, and he just kept on going. And every 4 years, we'd have this email crossover, because we never actually talked. We never met until after the film was made. And I just believed in him, a nice guy, very, very into the story, and was really committed to making it. We didn't know it was going to take 18 years for him to make it, but he was very committed to it. It was great, you know.
And the writing of the novel itself back, because it was 1997, I think, is that the year?
Yeah,
of publication.
Published, yeah.
So you were writing it at some point in the mid, early to mid 1990s, I'm guessing. But it took you
a while.
Go ahead.
I was writing. Sorry, you go ahead. Yeah.
No. You were going to tell me you were writing. Tell me when you were writing it.
I was actually writing it. It came out in 97. I was writing it in July, August of 96. basically speaking, I'd had 70 rejections of different works, and the only person who ever gave me feedback was Kay Cruz O'Brien. I came up with the idea for Jackie Loves Johnser. I had 32 pages written, and I ran out of paper. I was on the dole at the time. I thought to myself, well, I can't afford this, you know. So I actually sent the 32 pages, didn't get a copy or anything like that, and wrote a little note saying, listen, okay, I know you like my work, but I know you're a busy woman, so I'm not going to send the whole manuscript. And I just said, I'll give you the 32 pages. By that chance, about a month later, I'd got a job, and I rang my wife at home to say, listen, I've got a job. And she said, well, listen, you'd have to be asked for the whole manuscript. Panic stations, I got a dictaphone, and when I'd be driving to work, which is about a 2 hour drive, I'd speak into the dictaphone, hand it to my wife at night, she'd type it up, and I'd have the dictaphone again during the day. And between the hopping and the trotting, we got it done in 3 weeks. So I took 3 weeks to get Jackie Loves Johnser done, and a bloody Frenchman took 18 years to get the film.
I'm sure he has a funny name, sure. Why wouldn't it take him half a century to get it done?
But, I thought Johnny Giles was slow, and I said, this Giles fella is the slowest, you know.
But that is extraordinary, the way you talk about dictating it literally, and even the fact that it was a dictaphone brings us back in time to a certain point in terms of technology. But it tells me something possibly about the style of storytelling that I'm guessing is there pretty much in the novel, which is a kind of an oral style of somebody telling the story of this young pair, as we meet them initially, a pair of teenagers who just had the hots from each other from the very moment they saw each other. So you literally spoke the story out rather than wrote it out.
I literally spoke it out. And on top of that as well, I'm driving down the road one day, and what I do is, there's two voices in the story. Jackie and John's are basically, they tell the same story but from different perspectives, you know. And so I'm driving down the road, and it's a part that I had to write about Jackie. And because you're trying to get into the voices of her, that I'm talking in a kind of as close to a woman's voice as I can get. You know, there's a guy called Terry Healy in Ballyfermot, he had a woman's voice. They used to impersonate him. But that's just a joke for him. But I was doing the voice. I was going, oh, John, you're the most gorgeous fella I've ever met in my life. I'm madly in love with you. And I just looked across from him. The window was open. It was a summer's day. And there's three guys in a truck looking at me. As if I'm like, I fucking lost the plot. And I turned around to the man and said, listen, lads, sorry, but I'm writing a book. And they said, would you ever go in hell? So that was how it actually came about. Was I'd change the voices and I'd talk into it. And luckily, we got it done in 3 weeks and nobody ever knew that the story behind it, you know, so we got it published.
Yeah, well, they know now. Well, I'm sure they knew before this point in time. But it is a romantic, and in many ways it is a romantic. It's a love story. It's a romantic. I don't know if comedy is quite the right word, but there's a high level of romance within this piece. However, there is quite a dark underbelly there as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, it's about a guy, how he gets involved in crime, how he gets to where he is and why, as happens at the start of the book, a guy puts his gun to his head in his own room, his sitting room. So it's like why a guy would have a gun pointed to his head. And my feeling behind it came from, you know, I've no problem with, like, you know, if criminals are killed and, like, it's reported in the papers. But they have family and they have children that aren't involved in crime. And so a bit of respect on the name calling that was going on, you know. And I just felt like, you know, people are calling terrible names. Keep that for another day, not when the children are probably going to be reading about their father, you know. And that was just how I felt. And so the idea came to me that, okay, at the start of it, we have a guy who we probably say, oh, he's a gangster. What the hell if he loses his life? And I kind of say, hold that idea. We'll go right back to the start of his life and we'll see his life, how it progresses, how the choices he made, and see it through the girl that loved him as well. And so then we come back at the end of it, gun still pointed at his head, but maybe, I'm just saying, maybe you want him dead, that's fine, but maybe you've changed your mind because you know the type of life they had to live. It was as simple as that.
Yeah, so there may, in this fictional world, there can be alternative endings that unfortunately don't always exist in the real world. But to go back to your friend, Johnny Giles Lelouch, as I'm going to have to call him from now on, Gilles Lelouch, he talked about this ultra-violent romantic comedy. I have to say, the way the film brings it to France, it feels as authentic in this French urban, a port town that we're in France. It feels as authentic there as you have described it in Ballyfermot. How do you think that authenticity, how did you achieve it in the novel and how do you think they've achieved it in the film?
Well, I just, like you see, maybe I was gifted in the way that I had to do it, that like I actually told a story, you know, and I just kept it real. And in the film, they've changed a lot in the film. They keep the heart of the story. You know, they keep the heart of the story. And he obviously knows his French audience a hell of a lot better than I do. He's had 4 million bums on seats in 4 weeks, which is absolutely mind-boggling, isn't it? You know? I think he kept it really strong. I think like anything, you know, when you listen to good songwriters or something like that, I used to listen to good songwriters and they tell a story and then you find out he's maybe from Tennessee or from New York and you kind of say, you know what, that felt like Ballyfermot to me. That felt like the same story in Ballyfermot. And so I tried to do the same with the novel, just make it working class. Of course, you kind of pick out things that people from Ballyfermot realise, yeah, he knows the area. As I said, there was a shop called the Elephant Supermarket in the 60s in Ballyfermot. I don't think there was an elephant supermarket anywhere else. But anybody who heard that would say, this guy's from our own, you know? And because, and Gilles done that, see, I've got his name right now. Gilles done that in the sense, in France, he put little French touches to it that I think resonated the French. And they've loved it. And there was a great a thesis or something done on it the other day where they looked at it and said, the critics got this wrong. The critics based it out of when it came out of Cannes. And he changed a few things. But he knew his audience, you know, everybody was saying it's nearly 3 hours. You're not going to get 14 to 20s sitting for 3 hours anymore. It's a love story, and by God, they've fallen for it, and they've kind of said, this is our love story of our generation, and this is our time and our place. And all I was reading an awful lot of the reviews from people who've gone to it, and the general consensus was, you know, this is the point now that other French films have to come to. And I think, you know, fair dues to the guy for doing that. You know, that's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, because it is pulling the French audience, or the French cinema owners are delighted that it's pulling in this much younger audience into see it. One of the things, and is this, I don't know if this was within the novel as well as within the film, Jonzer in the novel, Clotaire, which seems to be a very funny name in France for some reason. I don't understand why, but they all laugh at his name. And anyway, Clotaire in the film, when he goes into prison at a certain point, people can find out why and how that happens if they see the film or read the book. He goes into prison at a certain point, and while he's there, he writes out, he gets a dictionary. The female character has slagged him about his lack of vocabulary, because she's quite a bright young woman. And he gets a dictionary and comes up with 457 words to describe the beauty that is his love. Had you done that in the novel as well, or is that a cinematic invention, Simon?
I would love to take credit for that, but that's the genius of the scriptwriters there. I never even thought of it. I was too busy having Jonzer kicking the lard out of other people.
But it's a lovely touch that he has.
It's a beautiful touch.
That he has done that. You went to see you didn't go to Cannes, but you went to the premiere in Paris?
Paris, yeah, got to go to Paris. You know what, they treated us like royalty, you know, absolutely. You know, you've no idea how well you're treated, and then probably the next day you're back with your pennies bags running for the plane, you know. But prior to that, they absolutely were fantastic. And of all things, I sat in the back of the cinema to have a look at it, you know, right down. And of course, all the stars went up to the top. And fair dues to them, they said, at the back here is the guy who started it all, whose novel. And of course, that's stand up, and I got a standing ovation, so that was great, you know. Yeah, so I thought that was very...
Any word that the novel might be, it might get a French translation now, I'm sure people would be dying to read it.
I know, the French translation was what they actually
read. That's what they had read, of course.
Yeah, Le Mur Ouf was the French translation. That happened in 2000, and they got it in 2002. Yeah, so that's it. It's already, since it's come back out, it's been re-released, as has Jackie Loves Jonzer. Jackie Loves Jonzer has been re-released by Mercier Press. Yeah. It's only available online at the moment. But, you know, go to them. And in France... since September, it's gone through three reprints already because of the film. You know, it's incredible.
What about an Irish film version of it? Any nudgings or talkings about that?
You know, look, it was there for 5 years. And, you know, people knew about it. They knew the kind of cult thing that had got. And nobody came to us. Still nobody's come to us, you know. It's just the way it is. You get annoyed about it in the beginning, and now it's just like, oh, look, it'll happen. What happens, happens. You know what I mean? I don't think, in fairness to anybody in Ireland, and even my thoughts, I don't think anybody would have got 39 million to make it, and that's what Gilles got, you know?
Yeah.
So it's an incredible budget that he got. And I don't think we would have got, I think we would have had a different spin on it, probably more like the novel. But the thing is, you were saying about like the French and stuff like that, like, if you were asked, or I was asked, I think, which version of Nothing Compares to You is the penultimate version, even though Prince wrote it, you'd be saying Sinead, she can't be beaten, you know?
Yeah.
And then when you see the film, the Prince one actually, it sits in nicely. And he's done that a lot with different things, you know? I'm fair to say.
Yeah, because one of the things, again, which brings us back in time, there's a mixed tape. One of the things that Clotaire gives to the female character, whose name won't come to me now when I'm trying to think of it here. Jackie.
Jackie.
Yeah. One of the things that he gives to her is a mixtape, of course, which has Nothing Compares to You on it, the Prince version. And I believe that has become a bit of a deal now with French teenagers, that suddenly they're realising the joys of being given a cassette tape from somebody you fancy.
It's funny, isn't it? It's funny the way things go around, you know. But the funny thing that I seen the other day, because they gave me a vinyl, you know, for the soundtrack. It was very nice. They gave us a lovely vinyl for it. And the Prince track isn't actually on the vinyl, so there must be some contractual thing that you can't get the Prince version. So it's kind of funny. I actually, if I had had my choice, and I'll still say it to today, and the Lord rest him and stuff like that, but I'd have gone for Crazy World by Aslan, you know, personally.
Right, yeah.
And I think it could have brought new generations to them, you know.
Yeah, and that would very much speak to an Irish audience. However, we have to talk about the biggest critic of them all. I think was this at the point at which you wrote the novel first, and it had a moderate level of success. What did the Ma say?
She rang me, you know, and again, we're a throwback, you know, the answer machines on your phone, you know, your phone at home and the answer machine. And I had gone up to Ballyfermot, I'd given her the novel, and I said, Matt, don't read it in front of me, you know, you'll embarrass me. So by the time I got home, there were two messages on the phone. The first one was, she said, I'm after checking under the beds, under the sofa and everything. I can't find the other seven kids I'm supposed to have had, you know, because there was 13 kids in the book,
in
you know.
The book, yeah.
And then, next message was, and your father walks around the house naked, does he, and flashes it to everybody and anybody which the father in the book again. So I rang her up anyway. I said, nah, like, you know, you got to take it, this is a fictional book. And she says, oh, you know that. And she says, I know that. She says, but the neighbours don't know that. So she didn't talk to me till actually Gay Bourne 6 months later said it was a great novel, and she started talking to me again.
All right. So once Gabo gave it the blessing, she was happy. She was happy to take that on board.
Yeah. She never listened to a word I said anyway, you know, for all of the years, so it didn't make any sense. But it was funny the way she just, it wasn't really, she knew what it was fiction and all that, yep. But she thought, there's going to be a neighbour having a look at it, you know?
you have to watch out for the neighbours. I presume, will you be there at the screening on Saturday? Will you go to see it here in Dublin?
Oh, absolutely.
Are you in Dublin at the moment, or are you over in your villa?
I'm in my villa, yeah.
In Spain.
in Spain, yeah. I got an interview recently and somebody was very serious. And in the middle of the interview, they turned around and said, are you very rich, you know? So what a weird question to ask anybody. I turned around and said, well, as I was saying to the chauffeur, or was it the butler the other day, right? And I just let it ride like that. I just left it like that. I seen the interview, and on the interview was, Thompson has really made a huge amount of money from this and has a butler and a chauffeur. So be careful of what you say to anybody. No, I wanted to go. I was supposed to actually make a few words at the start of before the film was shot and stuff like that, or shown, I should say, in the IFC, which is actually sold out, I heard today, totally sold out. But of all things, thanks to Ryanair and the ridiculous prices of fares, I couldn't make it, you know. It was just, it didn't make sense for the couple of days I was going to be there, you know. It's like 500 quid each, you know, to go.
You should have booked a year and a half ago. You would have got it for $2.99.
I could have got the chauffeur to drive me home.
There was always that option. Listen, Neville, lovely to speak with you, and continued success. Looking forward to seeing and hearing more of your work. Because certainly,
this is a really, really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Not at all. That's Neville Thompson, author of the novel on which the film is based. The novel, Johnser Loves Jackie. Okay, the film is Beating Hearts, or L'Amour of the Irish French. The IFI French Film Festival runs through until November the 24th. The screening, which we think might be sold out, but worth checking it out, is on Saturday the 23rd at 8:10 in the evening. IFI.ie. We'll give you all of the details there. And the novel Jackie Loves Johnser Okay is published by Mercier Press. Rugby, golf and tennis have their grand slams, and this weekend so too has Dublin's spoken word poetry scene. This coming Sunday, November the 24th, the arts collective We Are Griot will host the Talkative's Grand Slam Poetry event. The Grand Slam takes place at the Pawn Shop on Dublin's Dame Street, 6:30 on Sunday evening. See the cream of spoken word crop take part in a competition that is decided by marks, awarded by judges and the live audiences. I'm delighted to be joined by poet and member of the We Are Griot ensemble, De Gogo Hart, to studio with us this evening. I'm just asking you about the whole idea of slam poetry, and you immediately got stuck into how competitive it is, De Gogo.
Exactly, yes. The rules are very, very strict. You have 3 minutes to perform your poem. Some slams are even stricter. You have 1 minute or 2 minutes, depending on how many people are performing. But ours is 3 minutes anyway. We're kind of nice like that. But you have 3 minutes. There's no reading or music or props to kind of like boost it. It's just literally you, your voice, your performance, and that's it. And you kind of have to, you know, woo the judges and the audience as well. Yeah.
And is there a gladiatorial aspect to it then? Is it like thumbs up if you're going through to the next round and thumbs down if you're gone?
So here's the thing. With our venue, where we put the artists is kind of like at the back so they can hear everything. And the way the audience voting works is they get scorecards and we call out, the host call out the scorecards. So like, you got a 10, you got a 9, you got... So they do, there is some, you know, something very close to that element when they are hearing their scores being called out. So yes, it gets very competitive, yeah.
And I was asking you, you have, in a previous life, several slams along the way.
Yes, there used to be a slam called Slam Sunday when I started up. So I won that a few times. I also won one of their Grand Slams, which is like the big one at the end of the year. There was what was it called back then? There was a few ones anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might have won the provincial ones. Or
exactly, yeah. I think the Slam Sunday one was the biggest one, but also the All-Ireland. I came third in that one. I never won that one. I came third. But the All-Ireland is also very, very big because you then go to basically represent Ireland against the rest of the world.
Wow. Yeah,
it's a big deal, yeah.
To what extent do you think, and it's always, a point of debate around spoken word artists, to what extent does it depend on the nature of the person in question, their ability to perform the piece as much as it is about the content of the piece?
Exactly, yes. So like the judges would be judging you based on the content, which is, you know, kind of what people would know poetry for. But as a spoken word artist or as a performance poet, you're also required to be a very good performer. So you'd also be getting judged on your performance. So, you know, the emotion of the poem and how you're able to, you know, translate that with your performance, how you're able to like carry a crowd, the emotional journey that the poem takes us through and how you're able to deliver that. You know, sometimes it's high and angry, sometimes it's low and a whisper, and being able to use all those variety of performance tools at your disposal.
But interesting that you say you cannot have props, you cannot have music.
So exactly.
You can't kind of dress it up with fancy lighting and fancy stage
effects.
Exactly.
There's no hiding.
Just you.
There's no hiding.
How nerve-wracking is that?
Well, I remember the Grand Slam that I won, and it was literally an Eminem situation. I was in the back trying not to get sick right before I went on stage. So it's extremely nerve-wracking, especially the big ones. Yeah, yeah.
You have a piece that you're going to perform for us this evening.
I do. It's kind of like two poems smashed into one because they come from the same story, the same short film that I did a few years ago about this fictional character called Redbeard Paddy. And the first one is kind of like, you know, getting to know the character, his identity. And the second one is a love poem. So the first one is called Cup Full of Pennies. The sun had dipped into the ocean and sizzled out its bright. The sky was a bipolar devil trying to glow in the dark. He was a man with a red beard and a cup full of pennies. From all the time, souls like mine had wandered here seeking his story. In some way, he was a memory of the past. Words of light that cast shadows of the men we used to be, but he was also the hope for the future. A seed breaking out of a shell, learning to trust the earth. Knowing people aren't always good, but aren't always bad either. He said, if I ever do die, I can take care of my soul, but someone, please carry my body home. All I could say was, I will. All I could think was, I know a few things about being lost myself. I have perfected the art of drawing circles with my footprints, the sand between my toes. It's not from this beach. We are both travelers of some sort. So no room to feel, he began. We were men. We were Irish men. Our hearts of stone was never for evil. It just had to be strong enough to protect the people in it. See, that's the problem with poets. The sunsets were never meant to be stared at. It was the only sign that we had fought the sun that day and won, and sunrise was a new day's battle cry. The stars were never meant to be gazed at. The only reminders that anything that can only glow in the dark will always remain small and common, so no room to fail. Maybe every silver lining is lightning, and thunder is the sound your body makes when it hits the ground. You, my dear boy, are trying so hard to touch the clouds. There's ground that needs breaking. There's ground that needs breaking. So leave dreams for sleeping men. Leave sky for birds, and leave tears for shoulders strong enough to carry them. What do I know? I'm just an old man collecting yesterdays till tomorrow comes and you are a young man with the foolish of pride but the wisdom of time. The sun's coming up. Live a penny in the cup.
De Gogo Hart with his poem, A Cup Full of Pennies. That really does bring us on an extraordinary journey, De Gogo, you know, from all poetry and the sun and all of these lovely kind of poetic images. But then you kind of pull it down to a very visceral level.
Very real level, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's what we try to do with the performance as well as the words as well. Try to bring that, you know, to something. Because I think spoken word poetry is the oldest form, because before there was written word, there was oral, the oral tradition of poetry. So that's, we're essentially like storytellers in that way.
And in fact, that links into the arts collective, We Are Griot.
Yes.
Griot is a language, you might explain the origins of that language and where how that fits into your...
It essentially means like a West African bard. They are like, you know, the storytellers, they are the ones that... you know, carry the custom from one generation to the next, and the histories and the poems, you know, the praises for the king, things like that. So we are essentially that in modern day form. We're trying to carry on the stories and this poetry and all that, yeah.
And in terms of, you mean, that bardic tradition, as you say, would have involved praising the king or the queen.
Exactly,
but it
yes.
might also have involved giving a slightly barbed... Being able
yeah,
to
so
say
it depends
negative.
On where you are. You know your audience. If you're in the palace, you're doing a different poem than if you're in the streets. Exactly.
And do you feel that kind of political aspect? Because obviously you're not talking about kings and queens nowadays necessarily. Mm. You're probably talking about the powers that be, the politicians, things like that.
Yeah.
Do you think that political aspect is in vitally important to spoken word?
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, not only is it like part of it, it's also important for the poets to also be able to reflect the society that you're in, be it politics in a grand scale or on a communal level, community level. I think it's very, very important that, you know, our art is basically reflecting that from, you know, the family to the streets, to the community and to the nation.
Who will be performing at this event?
You put me on the spot now.
Oh, right, I have some of the names here.
Yes, there's 10 poets. I think we've announced 7 or 8 so far. We're kind of like drip-fitting the audience. Give them entice. I know Roxana, Heavy Kevy.
Roxana and Acclaim is one of the ones, yes.
Yes, yes.
Heavy Kevy. Is Pixie and Sean Walsh, have they been announced yet?
Yes, they have. Yes,
thanks
yes,
be to God.
Sean Walsh was the first announcement.
I don't want to announce somebody that you're holding off, announcing until closer to the time. The other thing we've been talking a lot about, the political side of it, I suppose, and how it can take twists and turns. The other vital component, I often think, in spoken word is humour.
Yes, I mean it depends on the poet as well, but I think. Part of, you know, being a performer is being able to, like, interact with your audience on some level, and humor helps with that. So some poets lean into it more than others, obviously. Yeah. But it's a very useful tool in, you know, in your arsenal to be able to relate to your audience and be able to get them on your side, especially if they are voting for you. You know, a laughing audience is a 10-point audience.
More likely to put up their hand.
Exactly, yes, yes.
All right. Well, listen, best of luck with the event and thanks for coming in to speak to us.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
De Gogo Hart. And the Talkatives Grand Slam Poetry event takes place Sunday evening, November the 24th at the Pawn Shop in Dublin 2. Buy tickets on the door or in advance at eventbrite.ie. Michael Kiwanuka has released a new single, Rebel Soul, from his forthcoming album, Small Changes, which arrives this Friday, the 22nd of November. It is one of 3 albums that we will be reviewing on Friday evening's programme. Let's have a listen to Rebel Soul.
Can't watch you fall, cast your devils on to me. Gotta break all those chains. Scared to show all of your rebel soul, but I won't mind. But I won't mind. Oh, it's about that time.
Why should I be afraid for you to go? Take back what I stole. Well, I don't mind. No, I don't mind.
Soulful sound indeed there from Michael Kiwanuka, and that from his fourth studio album. It's called Small Changes, and the song that we listened to was Rebel Soul. As I say, Small Changes is one of our three albums up for review on Friday evening, alongside new work and new albums from Father John Misty and Kim Deal. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening here on RTE Radio 1. Leah Murphy was the researcher, Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Harry Bookless was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news at 8 o'clock.